today, and I appreciate everyone's pitching in here and working out something for the hymns this afternoon, and it all worked out pretty good. Did you just carry your horns in the trunk just in case? Just kind of like, you know, your side arms? Run out there, get the horn. All right. Well, I'm glad. I thought, were we having special music or something? And no. So, okay. I didn't know what the program was. I'm grateful that you did, though. And I hope that you realize we have here in the congregation, and these two gentlemen are certainly part of this, professional musicians that, you know, have a lot of experience. And our choir leader here, you know, had his own band and so on in the past. And the other gentleman has a master's degree in music. And so they are well qualified, and I'm very grateful that they're here, especially today. Well, I would like to ask you the question here this afternoon. Are you ready? Are you ready? And that's the question, or not the question, but that's the exhortation that Jesus Christ gave his disciples when they ask, when are you coming back? And what are going to be the signs? What's going to be happening? And all the things that he explained, but he, or I should say, at the end of everything he explained, in all three accounts, he warns them, he warns us to be ready, not to relax, not to fall asleep, not to take it easy. I'd like to review, because everybody always wonders, how much time do we have? When is Christ going to return? I know one particular person who's been saying that we only have maybe 5 or maybe 10 years, and they've been saying that for 30 years now. And the answer is he doesn't, and nor do we know. That's the truth of the matter. But we can get some indications, and I will guarantee you we're going to look at a few things here, which will give us a better idea of kind of where we are right now. Because there is no question that prophecy, very clearly listed in the Bible, is marching along. And we have to be ready. We don't want to sit back and say, you know, the proverbial thing that Christ mentions, the Lord delays his coming. Christ is not delaying his coming at all. Everything is going right down the line. But it just takes a period of time, which is much different than we might imagine. And it's really difficult or virtually impossible for us to know with any specific time frame exactly when Christ is going to return. But we can know when we're getting close, when we are getting close to the season and the time. And Christ tells us that. But he also says that nobody is going to know the day or the hour. Only the Father knows that, not even the angels. And so, you know, we're contrary to the Bible if we start predicting when Christ is going to return. And isn't that such a favorite thing for various groups and leaders, I shouldn't say groups, but various leaders to do? How many times have people predicted a date, been on the top of a mountain, you know, with their people, and said, you know, Christ is going to come back on this date, whatever, and they stand there, and of course he didn't come back. Then they have to come up with some kind of reason or excuse as to why that didn't happen. And why they're still right, and why they're still the one to be listened to. So let's not make that mistake. But on the other hand, let's not be ignorant either and fall into the trap of saying, well, Christ is delaying what he's going to do, and we don't even have to think or worry about that. All right, let's just go down the list here. I listed out a whole bunch of things that are current right now that are happening in the world that we are facing as a country. First of all, we have, and this was on the Elders Forum, which is an email sharing a comment session among the ministry, and one of the fellows was mentioning how the housing over in Detroit area, or that general area around Detroit, had over the last 2 years has dropped about 50% in value. Now, other people in California reported, of course, their housing costs or values have gone down dramatically. Florida has dropped dramatically. But then, you know, they gave, one of the fellows suggested a website put out by the CIA, which was pretty interesting. I never even knew this existed. And it lists the conditions of the country and our deficits and so on, which I'll mention here in a little bit. But I'm wrong. It wasn't the CIA site that had this information. It was a real estate organization that listed all the houses, the values of homes throughout the whole country, the major cities. And the interesting thing was that Chicago was only down, oh, maybe 3 to 5% at the most. Pretty stable here. The West Coast and Florida and some places on the East Coast, or especially Michigan, Michigan being hit because they have terrible job losses there, and that hit them 2 or 3 years ago, well, about 2 years ago. And it's a really, really bad situation. And I've known about that because of this company that I represent over there. And the owner of the company has this beautiful house right on the golf course. And he said another man spent over $1 million for his home, and he's trying to sell it. And he'll be lucky if he gets $500,000 for it, if he can even sell it. So that area has been economically hurt because of the auto market and that whole and the foreign incursion of other automobiles into this country. But the other places were driven up, as they have been in the past, in Florida and California by speculation. And so it's obvious that they would drop. But the rest of the country really had some areas that were up for 5, even 10%, others that were holding about neutral, others that were down a little bit. So it hasn't really affected us in the Midwest as badly as, except for Michigan, as it has in other places. But that was very interesting to see that. And that's definitely where you have these big swings up and down. California is very heavily populated, and so is Florida. And it affects this country and the economy, and especially there in Michigan, where it has been terribly dramatic. And of course, they're working as hard as they can to try to get new industry in there, but it's not going to happen overnight. Saw the same kind of thing happen during the 80s when all the steel mills closed down. Not only here, but especially over in Cleveland and Youngstown, and people who were making a good wage working there in the steel mills, when they all closed, then both the husband and wife had to go to work for a much lower income each just to get along. Now, they've gotten along okay over there, but it's not good, and it's still a problem there, but it's slowly rebuilding. Other industries are moving in. We have a situation right now where we have the largest, this is the one that was on the CIA website, we have the largest deficit, I guess it was $700 trillion of any country in the world, just behind England. And what that meant was that more money is going out of this country than coming in. So our wealth is just going out. And where is it going? Well, to buy all these goods from China and from other countries because they're inexpensive. And our manufacturers have stopped manufacturing here, and they've either built plants or moved over to China or importing goods from China and selling them here. And so all this money is going out of the country, and not very much is coming back in. Places like, I was surprised, Sweden and Finland and Germany, of course, and various other European countries, they have a positive situation where more is coming in than going out. So our wealth is just leaving. We have a lot of it, though, and that's how we're standing in the gap right now, is the fact that we just have so much money here and so much wealth. But it's going, and it's going quickly. Of course, then we have $100 a barrel oil. We really need that. It was about 102 yesterday, if I was watching it there. I don't know. I think that's about where it closed. Okay, gold is almost $1,000 an ounce. It's never been that high before. They predicted it years ago, the last time it went shooting up, that it was going to go to 1,000. I think it made 800 or something, but it never made 1,000. The dollar is sinking in value, and it's at historic lows right now against the euro. And pretty soon, I can't remember who mentioned this to me, but not too long from now, there will be a president of the common market there, and he will be sitting over the most powerful organization in the world. Our dollar is very weak against it. The only benefit we get out of that is companies like Caterpillar and others who and John Deere, who are exporting a great deal of their product overseas, are really, really competitive because the foreign companies or countries can buy our goods at a lot lower price because their currency is stronger than ours. So that's a benefit, and that's helped the trade situation not be as bad, but it certainly isn't. I mean, you can't let your dollar just, your currency just keep sinking. You're going to pay the price eventually if you do. The stock market has been going up and down like a yo-yo, and no one can decide whether we're in a recession. We're about to go into a recession. I don't know how much of that is even politically motivated because of the election coming up. It would be helpful to one party if we were in a recession and they could pump that up. A lot of analysts say we are not in a recession, that we're going to recover by the end of this year, and we only can wait and see. I'll tell you that in industry, it was going very, very strong right up to the end of last year. January came and it died, and we hardly got any phone calls or any responses. And then pretty soon towards the end of January, it began to pick up, and it's going okay at this point as far as activity is concerned. But it's definitely slower. There's no question about that. Jobs are, well then, no, not the jobs yet, but the USA has one of the highest debts that we've ever had. And just to explain why this is so critical, foreign countries, China, Europe, various other countries, Japan, buy our savings bonds, our bonds, okay, because they feel like it's a safe thing. And we have a bond issue. We print up paper, all right, and we have an auction, and people buy these bonds. They give us their money in exchange for this piece of paper, which is a guarantee that they're going to get that money back plus so much interest. Now, that's backed by the U.S. government, and it's a very real simple principle to understand, and when you understand it, you'll see why we are in a pretty precarious position right now. We sell a lot of bonds. A lot of foreign people have purchased these bonds. We owe them lots of money. We have taken their money, and we don't just put it in the bank. We go spend it on whatever, government things. That's why we have bond issues. When you want to, if you're living in a town and they want to put a new road or a new building or something, they have a bond issue. This would be a municipal bond, and it's the same thing. They sell the bond, you give them the money, they promise to give you your money back plus this interest rate. And hopefully, by the end of 5 years or 10 years, they have the money to pay you. But then they take your money and they spend it on building whatever they're going to build, the project. So, unfortunately, we have, just as overall principle, we have borrowed virtually so much money from foreign investors that it's going to be, you know, it could be a critical situation of, if they all came over here and said, we want our money today, we could have a real problem. Now, one of the reasons they don't do that is because even though you hear people on the news saying, oh, this is an international economy, and even if the United States goes into recession, the rest of the world, their economy is booming and it's going to be going. Well, in a couple of days after that was all being touted, stock market took a monster dump earlier this year, and guess what happened? All around the world, all those markets took a dump. And the reason they did is because they do depend still on this country to run and influence the world. Now, the day will come, unfortunately, if we keep going the way we are, where that won't be true. And where, and this is the worry of a lot of economists right now, is that the euro being so strong and Europe is holding their interest rates and we're dropping ours, so it makes it less advantageous for people to invest in this country. And maybe they'll say, well, we're pulling our money out of these bonds and we're going to go put it over into the European market because we can get better return. And if that begins to happen, things could collapse in a dramatic way. And the economists know that. I've heard them talk about it on the TV. I watch as much as I can the business channels and so on. And you, when you get the really older, experienced people there, they say, yeah, this is a potential big problem. The other big problem, this Mr. Seidman on CNBC there, who's their banking expert and an older man that's been around for many, many years in the banking business, he was mentioning this insurance. We have bond insurers and so on. Well, with all this default with the mortgages and everything, these bond insurers and these mortgage insurers don't want to take on the responsibility. And he just was very frank about it. He said if they don't get that fixed pretty soon, it could be a real disaster. And it could really mess up the economy. Now, all these factors that we're talking about isn't just one thing. These are all part of a picture that we need to be aware of. There's more. Of course, jobs are leaving because in other words, the people aren't leaving to go to China, but the jobs are, and people are getting or have been laid off. And so the manufacturing aspect of our economy, which used to be very big and very strong, was always the most profitable thing to be in, was manufacturing, is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and we're now depending on others to do that. And the thing that really, really shocked me yesterday was when Boeing lost the order to the Air Force, to the European, I could not believe my ears. I mean, that has got to be, in my opinion, the stupidest thing we could do. We heard our own workers, but say, oh, well, they're going to put a plant up here. Yeah, but where is the profit they're going to make off of the business? Where is that going? Back to Europe. They're not going to stay here. So that was just unbelievable. And, of course, this morning they had they were showing all the Boeing workers picketing and getting really, really upset about this situation, and they're going to contest it and so on. So we'll see. That was a real shocker. And I just couldn't believe it. All right, we also have inflation beginning to actually come back, and the inflation is hitting our food supplies because we're producing ethanol, right, to put in our gas tanks, but that has driven the price of corn off the wall. Am I correct in this? I thought I saw this the other day. I know that wheat was up to $800 or $900 at one point, and I saw it flash across the other day, Thursday or whatever, at $1,200. I mean, it's just, if you have wheat, if you're a farmer and you have wheat to sell, you're going to be doing all right. But it is driving these prices crazy because everybody began to raise corn. All the farmers said, corn is where it's at. And that's why John Deere and other tractor manufacturers are doing so incredibly well, because the government insisted that they produce this ethanol. And corn was one of the main and quickest areas to get it from. Now, you can get it from other things, but and they're beginning to look at that, but it's really not all that efficient, and you lose mileage in your car when you use ethanol because it doesn't have as much bang for your buck. It just doesn't have as big an explosion, so it doesn't give you as much power for the same amount used. And then we also are, this is getting a little discouraging, isn't it? And I mean, I just sat down and began listing all the things that I was aware of, and there are probably many others. Look at the wars that we're involved in right now. Wars, plural. We've got two wars that we're fighting. I mean, one war or one enemy that we're trying to fight, but we have two major fronts. And when you divide yourself, of course, that's very, very bad. It's not good. Then you have Kosovo. That's boiling around over there. And the wars are going to be a major, major political football or major, major political question in this election coming up as the president. Who is going to be best suited to handle this country in the face of war? And everyone's going to be claiming that they are. So we'll have to put up with that for the next 12 months or 8 months or however long it is. And of course you see Al Gore's being proven out, I can't resist saying this, by the global warming. Come to my house and you'll see the snow is about that. It's way, way deeper up there than it is here. And I saw a picture on the Weather Channel of the whole northern, North American continent, and about one-third of this country is totally covered with snow. So the glaciers will be coming next, but don't worry about that. Anyway, obviously the Earth is, talking with Jack about this, who went up to Point Barrow up in Alaska and checked, you know, part of the scientific testing they've been doing, and it definitely is slowly warming. But there have been cycles like this before, and my opinion is it's a cycle, but we'll see. Here's one of the bigger ones. What's the moral condition of our country? It's a situation that I saw, and I know a number of you that have been worked at some of the major companies here in this area during the 80s, late 70s, and into the early 80s. I'm sorry to say, my generation began to take over the rule of the reins of power at that particular period of time. There was a major shift. I was in business early in the 70s, and it began to change right at about 78, 79, and 80, and it really changed in the early 80s. And that is this, that there used to be a certain unwritten set of rules that if you worked hard and you accomplished, you did certain things, and you were consistent in that, then you would be rewarded for that. And if you were quoting on a particular project for a big company, and you gave them your quotation along with drawings and specifications and so on, you didn't even have to worry about it. That was confidential. They would get a quotation from the other company. It was up to them to design their own idea and how they wanted to quote on the project. Well, when the next generation of leaders took over, all those ethics went out the window. No longer could you trust your customer who you were quoting to take your, you know, not take your drawing and just hand it to somebody else, their buddy over here. Here, all the engineering has been done. You quote on it now. And then they come in a couple of dollars cheaper and they get the job. So after that happened a few times, people that were doing the designing would purposely put in wrong designs in their quote so that if anybody, either that or they refused to give them a drawing, which is more common. And that's the way it is pretty much today. You want the drawing? Give us the order or give us a down payment. Here's the quote. You want the engineering work? You get it after we get your money because you can't trust these people. Now, it was never that way before. That was just ethics and business. That's the way it was. And you lived by those unwritten rules because that's just the way things were done then. And there was certain honor. I want to read something to you. I happened to run across this when we were, We have been moved around and transferred around so many times. We have boxes in our basement that have never been opened for the last three moves. And so we're going through, you know, the moths come out, but no. But sometimes. But we've been going through all these papers, and I came across a letter from 1972 that Mr. Armstrong had written to the whole church. It was based on a financial crisis there in the work at that time, and that's when we were laid off with a whole bunch of other people because the income had been going down for a number of years. And he was writing a very impassioned, not just asking people for money, but asking them to get closer to God, because this is what he began to see was the real problem that people had let down. Well, he recounted in this letter, and this is a quote out of his autobiography, and this goes along with the morality of this country. He said, "I want to add right here something I recorded in my autobiography. In January 1920, and you all know that Mr. Armstrong began his business here in Chicago, and when he came to visit back in the 80s, I happened to be the limo driver, and I didn't know this, but he always liked to sit up in the front, so he and I were up there driving around Chicago, and he was showing us the place, you know, the different houses that they lived in, and he showed us his office, where his office, with the building still there, and all, you know, telling the stories of how his business developed, and then what happened here that he's going to describe. But a lot of history took place with him right here in this city. And it says, in January 1920, the well-known statistician Roger Babson was the speaker at one of our Association of Commerce luncheons. Now, he was involved with all of these business leaders, and he was in the, in this case, it was an Association of Commerce. He was in the advertising business. He was a representative for a number of these big magazines, what we call trade magazines, people like International Harvester, John Deere, so on. They were banking magazines, and these companies would advertise in these magazines, and that's how he made his money. So he was in these associations. He kept tabs on what was going on in business, and he was in one of these annual meetings or luncheons then being held each Wednesday at the Cameo Room in the Morrison Hotel downtown Chicago. Through the Advertising Club, a division of the Chicago Association of Commerce, I had been a member of the association for some years, and he was part of the Advertising Club. We were then at the very height of a wave of post-war prosperity, and that was after World War I. This was 1920. "Gentlemen," said Mr. Babson, "we are about to enter the worst business depression that our generation has ever experienced." Now, he was the guest speaker. He's telling these people things are booming, things are going well, and he gets up there and says, "We're going to get the worst thing we've ever experienced." He said, "I advise you all to set your houses in order. I advise against any further plans of expansion until this depression has passed over." Seated at the tables in the large room were leading bankers, business executives of Chicago. I glanced around the room. I saw amused smirks animate the faces of many of the prominent men, like, "You're right." Through the next few months of 1920, business activity continued its boom upswing. Before the end of 1920, however, Roger Babson's predicted depression did strike. With sudden and intense fury, by January 1921, a year later, we had reached and passed its lowest ebb. At this time, Roger Babson, once again, was the guest speaker at the Morrison Hotel Cameo Room Association of the Commerce Luncheon. "Well, gentlemen," he said, "you will remember that a year ago I warned you that within a year we would be in the throes of the worst depression our generation has ever seen. I noticed many of you smiling unbelievably then. Well, that year has rolled around, and here I am again, and here is the depression with me." Chicago business leaders were not smiling now. Mr. Babson had proceeded to explain why he knew what was coming and the business executives did not. He at least shared now with them why he knew what was going to happen. He said, "It is now midwinter. If I want to know what the temperature is now in this room, I go over to the wall and look at the thermometer. If I want to know what is, if I want to know what it has been up to now and the existing trend as of the moment, I look at a recording thermometer. But if I want to know what the temperature in this room is going to be an hour from now, I go to the source which determines future temperatures. I go down to the boiler room and see what is happening down there. You gentlemen looked at bank clearings, indexes of business activity, freight car loading, stock market quotations, and you looked at the thermometer on the wall. I looked at the way people as a whole were dealing with one another. I looked to the source which determines future conditions. I have found that that source may be defined in terms of righteousness. When 51% or more of the whole people are reasonably righteous in their dealings with one another, we are headed into increasing prosperity. When 51% of the people become unrighteous in their business dealings with their fellows, then we are headed for bad times economically." He said, "I have never forgotten Mr. Babson's explanation. I hope my readers today, nearly 42 years later, and of course it's 70-some years now or more, 42 years later, may remember and profit by it." Mr. Armstrong said, "I paid with the loss of my business to learn the lesson." A very, very interesting observation. Now, where are we morally in this country? Well, we aren't going in the positive direction. And everybody in business, if they've been around for a long time, and it isn't just, you know, I don't want to just talk about business. I'm talking about the relationships and with one another and the things, how people treat each other. That sense of honor. Now, the company, one of the companies I represent, the owner of the company, and he's still running it actively, he's 85 years old. He is a multimillionaire, but he does things on a handshake. If he says, "This is what we're going to do," it's done. You don't have to worry about him changing his mind or trying to undercut you or cheat from you. There aren't too many people like that around anymore. His son was running the business for a number of years. He wasn't like his father. His father had to fire him and come back in and run it himself again because you couldn't trust this man, and he did what was good for him. And that is how so many businesses are run by leaders today who we call, when we talk about these things, well, the bean counters are in control. And the bean counter mentality, I guess, is taught in business school, is a very ruthless thing. They don't care about you as a person. You are a number, okay? And if you make money for us, good. And if I can make money by getting rid of you or figuring out some way to take away your retirement program or whatever, I will do that. And this has been done over and over and over, and I get really upset when I see companies, little companies that have been around for 100 years and being purchased by these big investment companies, and then they just rape the money and they cheat the employees, and then they sell the company and it all goes away after a lifetime of developing and building it. People have no, well, I didn't say people, many people in leadership positions in companies have no loyalty to their employees. And I'm not saying all are that way, because there are still a few companies where they're privately owned and they do have that. But so many today, and you know this, you know, you used to think, well, I'll work hard at this company and I'll be here the rest of my life. Don't hold your breath. You're probably going to be working for three or four companies in your career, because nobody has any loyalty. And when the bottom line comes, I know companies in the past who would keep their employees on, and they saved in their own company business, they saved a nice big reserve to help keep those employees going. They'd have them sweeping the floor and painting and doing everything, even though there wasn't anything to do, just to keep them on, so when the business picked up, they'd be there. And the owner of the company, the one I represent, is that same way. And he's not stupid, but on the other hand, he is very loyal to his people. And he appreciates that, and they appreciate him. And so it works very well. But it's a situation where that's not the way it is in general business today, and it's not the way it is in this country anymore. It's all this greedy stuff, whatever I can get for myself. And one of our presidents, didn't set a very good example in the way he conducted himself. So it just belies the attitude. That's not based on the little story we read by a financial person, not a very good indicator for the position this country is in right now. It's a very frustrating thing to watch. Let's go to 2 Timothy. And get into the Bible and see what the Bible says about this. 2 Timothy, the third chapter. Let's see if we don't see this exact attitude described. And you already know the verse I'm going to read here. I'm sure you've heard it many, many times. And it immediately came to my mind. I thought, well, I don't even have to explain this. He tells us exactly what's going to happen. 2 Timothy, the third chapter. And this is talking about the last days. I mean, how much plainer could it be? Verse 1, this know also. I'm reading out of King James, I'm sorry. This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. What I'm trying to give us all a picture of here and kind of an overview is, we are in the last days. How much longer God is going to allow this to continue, and where it's all going to, how it's all going to work out before those last things, which are clearly described in Matthew 24 and Revelation, actually start happening, because the many of those things, of course, obviously are not happening right now. But look at all the things that are happening, and here's the warning. Paul is saying in the last days, perilous times are going to come. Men shall be lovers of their own selves. And I can attest, over the last 25 years, I have seen that get stronger and stronger. Covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers. How many people today believe in God at all? That number continues to go down, doesn't it? The Christian religion in this country, I just saw another report on the news the other day about how many people are still Christians and whatever, and of course they're looking at it from a political point of view, how many votes are they going to get, but the Christian churches are losing people, and there are a lot of people, or an increasing number of people, who have, they're atheists or they have no church, and a lot of the younger people aren't associating themselves with any religion at all. Even though they may not understand the truth that we do, it still teaches people certain morals. Right, wrong, honest, work hard, do these things. Consider other people. It teaches people, young people, principles. They're not getting those principles today. Disobedient to parents. Oh, well, I wonder if we ever observe that anymore today. With our children, or not our children, but with children in this society. You saw that thing played over and over, that bus thing where the kids were teenagers or yelling at the bus driver, and don't touch me, and I'll sue you, and all this stuff. I mean, it's just no, whatever is good for me. And of course, unfortunately, the young people learn it from their parents. So they're disobedient to the parents, they're disobedient to other, older people. They don't have any respect, they're unthankful. The society we have, even though we're going in the down position, we have more today than we have ever had in the history of this country. And we have all these gadgets and all, you know, look at the automobiles. You go to a car show and you look at the 50s automobiles, which were the big rage and so on then. And then you look at the comfort and luxury, totally computer controlled automobile, way more computer controlled than we realize. I was talking to my mechanic, who was a very, very astute guy, and he said, well, you don't even realize how much the computer controls your car. When you lower the window, you push the button, it sends a signal to the computer. The computer checks the body computer to see if there's been an accident or anything is a problem. Can we open the window? And it goes, no, or, you know, we're fine, everybody's fine here. And then it finally sends a signal, of course this happens like that, electronically to the motor that finally lowers your window. It's not like it used to be, it was a wire hooked to the motor and you push the button. It all goes through the central processor. It's just incredible. All right, so we have things so good. Of course people are unthankful. Our children have grown up just having these things. They didn't know any other way. And their children are growing up with even more things. I mean, think about those of you who have grandchildren. How many toys do your grandchildren have? Sometimes they can even get into their room with all the stuffed animals that are in there and find a place to sleep. I mean, they have every toy you can think of and a whole bunch that you can't think of. And then they end up playing with a stick and a can someplace, you know. Seen that over and over. But certainly they're unthankful because they don't have any comprehension, because we are so blessed that the sad part is unholy. So they're blasphemy, you know, you believe in God, you're one of those religious nutcases. Unholy, without natural affection, they want what they want, and they don't care about you. I'm not talking about children, I'm talking about adults that have this attitude. Truce breakers. Yeah, I know I said I was going to do that, but I've changed my mind. Too bad. What are you going to do about it? False accusers. They accuse falsely to take care of themselves. They will say whatever they have to get what they want for themselves, to take care of themselves, to protect themselves. Incontinent, fierce. Yell, scream. You know, you yell louder than the other guy, you win. Despisers of those that are good. Oh, if you observe basic principles of right and wrong and good and whatever, and they're conducting their lives to do whatever they have to get what they want, and you abide by certain principles and rules, they hate you for it. They hate you for it. When you get hated and you get turned on sometime, don't be surprised for treating them nicely, because it'll happen if it hasn't already. They are traitors. They're heady. They're high-minded. They're lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having the form of godliness. Oh, they'll go to church and so on, but it's a social situation or a business benefit for them. Denying the power thereof, from such turn away. And then he goes on talking about false prophets and so on. But isn't that a description of where we are today? This is, you know, he said, this is what's going to happen in the end time. It wasn't like this 50 years ago in this country. If you went into the rural Midwest, or, I mean, you can still go to places, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and various other places that have been kind of sheltered from this, you won't find this kind of attitude. There's still, and hopefully 51% of the people or more, but I'm afraid that number is getting smaller and smaller all the time. That's what I'm personally become greatly aware of. How much time do we have left? Well, we don't know. We really don't. But we know this is very, very true. Let's go to Matthew 24, excuse me. And yet one of the reasons that I wanted to speak about this is because I don't want people thinking along the lines of, you know, this, or being influenced by people who are saying, oh, Christ is coming back tomorrow, he could come back anytime, so on and so forth. Believe me, we're going to know when it's a lot closer than it even is. But are these things taking place? Is the United Europe, has that already happened? Yes. You know, we prophesied out of the Bible that it was going to happen back in the 50s when Germany was still in the process and Europe was still in the process of recovery from bombed out buildings. And now they have a currency stronger than ours. Exactly what the Bible said was going to happen. Matthew 24, you see the same thing. Verse 3, the disciples come, they ask, what's going to happen? And when shall all these things be? And what shall be the sign of your coming? And that's what a lot of people are asking. And unfortunately, some people are answering it. You know, they're giving their answer of when the end of the world is going to be. And they don't really know. They're blowing hot air. Verse 4, and Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no man deceive you. The first thing that's going to happen is you're going to see more and more religious deception. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and they shall deceive many. Okay. And you shall hear. Now, we're doing more than hearing. We're actually in war. But you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end isn't yet. So even though we can say, oh, look at these wars going on, look at this, look at that, Christ said, just be patient. The end's a way down the road yet. Verse 7, for nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Has that happened in a major, major way? Absolutely, World War II. It happened already. It isn't going to happen. I mean, it is going to happen even more, but it already has taken place, a world war. And everybody thought, you know, looking at the Bible, oh, wow, this is the beginning of the end. Well, how many years has it been? 50 years, 60 years since the end of World War II. What's that to God? 50 years is nothing. 10 years is really nothing. 10 years is a lot to us. 20 years is a lot. Think of how old you'll be 20 years from now, or if you'll even be here. Okay, nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines. Okay, we have famines going on, and pestilences, and we have earthquakes. Now, we had one in Malaysia here about a week ago, then all of a sudden that one in Nevada, that was pretty heavy, 6 point something or 7, and then just the other day, very unusual, they had an earthquake in England. And so it's kind of hitting different spots in the world. And this is becoming a more common thing. Famines and pestilence and earthquakes in different places. All these things, he said, not the end yet, all these things are the beginning of sorrows. This is warm-up exercises, he said. Just the beginning. All right? Now, this next verse is what I want you to focus on. Because, and we'll look in the other two Gospels on this as well. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted. And they shall kill you. And you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then he goes on and says, and then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another, and many false prophets shall arise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity, again what we're talking about earlier, because iniquity shall abound, by this time they've thrown God out the window, just like Europe right now is basically non-religious for the majority of the people. England is pretty much the same way. They've kind of thrown their national religion under the bus. They make fun of it and everything else. It's still technically there, but not too many religious people in England. And because the iniquity shall abound, it's going to be way past that 51%, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that endures to the end, the same shall be saved. then it says about the gospel being preached. Now, we have the first part of what we read about. We have the wars, the rumors of wars. We've got the earthquakes, we've got famines. We have all indicators, and they keep getting worse as we go along. Now, we have to stand back and look at it in the big picture. World War II was definitely part of fulfillment of this. And now we're going on to whatever else is in store for us. He says, just the beginning of sorrows. But when it gets really serious, he said, when you know it's really getting close, is when they're going to deliver you up to be afflicted. They're going to take you before the councils. They're going to hate you. You'll be hated of all nations. And the question is, what is it going to take for this little, you know, pipsqueak group of people that we are to be so recognized that all nations are going to hate us? I don't know. But that's what Christ said is going to happen. And people are going to betray one another. Now, all through the rest of this chapter, he talks about what's going to happen in the tribulation. We're not in the tribulation right now. Some people think we are in the tribulation, but we aren't. When you get into the tribulation, brethren, you're going to know you're in the tribulation. This is not the tribulation that we're going through right now. But it will come. And we're getting closer to it, no question. And it's going to be terrible. In verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. That's bad. And except those days were shortened by Christ's return, nobody would be left alive. We have not gone through that yet. And he talks about verse 29, immediately after the tribulation, so the tribulation ends, and this all happens very quickly. The sun is darkened, and all these heavenly signs are shown, and that's just before Christ returns. Now, he does say in verse 32, now learn the parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is nigh. So likewise, and this is where people get fouled up, so likewise, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the door. When you start seeing the heavenly signs, when you've gone through the tribulation, when people are being persecuted and all these things, you know it's very close. However, he says about this generation wouldn't pass until these things were fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not. But of that day and hour knows no man, no, not the angels in heaven, but my Father only. So can we set a date? If you do, you're going against the Bible. But Christ did say that we can know that it's very close, but can you see what we still have to go through yet? Go over here we'll just take time to read Luke 21. This amplifies it a little bit more. Okay, Luke 21. Something is tickling my throat here. Verse 7. And they ask him the same question. What is going to be the sign when these things shall come to pass? And he said, take heed that you be not deceived, for many will come in my name, and so on. And verse 9, but when you shall hear of wars and commotions, don't be terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not yet, but it's coming. He said, but by and by, it's on its way. Now, what does by and by mean to God? How much time is that? Again, 10 or 20 years, this is nothing to God. And there's another factor here, brethren. The longer time goes, the more people God can call and convert. How many people does God want to call and convert before Christ returns? I don't know. So there's that factor that I thought about here a few weeks ago. And that's definitely part of his plan. And I don't know if that number has been, that tally has been reached or not. I don't know that. And we don't either. But that's all part of the program. But he said, and that may be the reason why nobody knows except the Father. When that number has been reached, then he said, then he'll say, okay, that's it. That's strictly speculation on my part. But it's definitely something that God's interested in, because he needs and wants, I should say, he doesn't need anything, but he wants people trained and prepared for his son's return, and they then can set up the kingdom. Okay, well, the wars and commotions, but he said it's by and by. Then said he unto them, nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and great, now he says something stronger. He said great earthquakes. He just said earthquakes in different places before. He said great earthquakes shall be in different places. Now, we haven't gotten into great earthquakes. We've had some pretty good sized ones, but not a great earthquake can be unbelievably devastating. And famines and pestilence and fearful sights, and now this is referring to the signs in the heavens. This is stronger. It says, fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. He didn't mention that in that context in Matthew 24. He mentions it later. But here he's more, this is a more advanced thing. But before all these, they shall lay their hands on you. Now he's talking to the disciples, not to the world. He said they're going to lay their hands on you and persecute you. There is a difference between persecution and tribulation. Persecution comes first. Remember in Revelation, it says the church was persecuted and the church fled, and God protected it and Satan tried to get it. It was persecuted. Didn't get destroyed. It says some of you shall they cause to be put to death. The majority of the people in the church, as we see it, saw in the New Testament, were not crucified or killed. It was, as I've said before, it mainly would be the leaders. And that's why I always carry Mr. Fay's name and address and phone number in my wallet, so they know who the guy in charge is. I mean, so, but that is the case. And that's the precedent already set. But before these things, they'll lay hands on you and persecute you. And this is all part of preaching the gospel around this world. How, you know, you heard what happened. We had this flash exposure about Christmas, you know, on TV and the radio interview. Hannity and Combs interviewed him on the liberal radio station there and all that. Why we don't, I mean, two or three of our ministers were interviewed. Why don't we believe in Christmas? Brethren, let's use our heads here. All the money in the world that we could ever put together, we could never get the publicity that something, when they grab you and say, hey, all the cameras in the world are going to be, it's all free. Now, we're not going to be smiling about it, but we're going to do something that he says here. They're going to put their hands, they're going to persecute you, they're going to deliver you up to the synagogues, to the ones in charge, and into prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. And he says, and verse 13, and it shall turn to you, or it shall be a testimony against them and for God. This is the key thing. I've experienced this in a couple situations, exactly what God says here, and some of you have expressed this, and you will, if we're alive at this time, experience it again. Settle it in your hearts, in your minds, not to meditate or not to worry ahead of time of what you're going to say. I will give you a mouth and wisdom, which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay nor resist. Believe me, God will give you, and you will be quite amazed. He will inspire you to say exactly the right thing. And you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren and kinsfolk and friends, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death. Didn't say all, It said some, because the majority of the church is going to be protected. And Revelation 3 says that's what's going to happen. And you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. Now, I don't know why everybody's going to hate us so much. That hasn't happened yet. That hasn't developed to that point. We're not there at this point right now. When this starts happening, then you can open the book and go, okay, we're right here now. And things are going to start happening much more quickly than the tribulation, because this is the predecessor, as Revelation says. We're going to be protected from the tribulation. We get persecuted first. Some people die. But the rest of the church is protected through the tribulation, and then these heavenly signs and all these other things begin to ramp up very quickly, and Christ comes back. But we aren't there yet. We're enjoying freedom. We're enjoying peace. But we got a little taste of it right there at Christmas time. Just a little taste, and that's how fast this can begin to happen. So how much time do we have? I don't know. But I'll tell you, we're a lot closer today than we were 30 years ago. A lot closer. With all these conditions and all the things that have been. And this is why in this, at the end of the chapter, it says, and this is the way each one of these sequences in Mark and here in Matthew 24, the lesson is, be ready. And that's why I entitled the sermon, Are You Ready? Verse 34, and take heed to yourselves. Don't rest, don't sleep, don't take it easy. The Lord delays his coming, we got plenty of time. Things can happen much faster than we expect. On the other side of the coin, brethren, things can drag on for a lot longer than any one of us wants to see it go. That's up to God. It could go either way. Truly, I say, or pardon me, he says, take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and the cares of this life. How easy would that be in this society? The cares of this life. And so that day come upon you unawares. For as a snare it shall come upon all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch you therefore, and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that you that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. That's a big warning right there, verse 36. Watch you therefore, be alert, be prepared, be ready, pray always that you may be counted by God worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and be able to stand before Christ when he does return. This is the Passover season is coming. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 11. Oops. And you know what I'm going to read here. This is a very serious time that we need to be thinking about. We need to look around us at how many things did I list here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Basically 12 things. I didn't particularly come up with any specific number. But at least 12 things that I could just see off the top of my head where we are in a position that this country has never really quite been in with all these factors. We've had this factor and that factor, but now all of these things are happening to us. So we better keep our eyes and ears open and better be alert. But if we live long enough to fall into the next category where we're going to be persecuted, where we are going to be brought before rulers and leaders, and we're going to have to answer for what we believe, we better be ready. We better be spiritually ready. We better have followed Christ's exhortation to be aware and be ready, not to have gone to sleep like, you know, five of the ten virgins did. And this helps remind us on an annual basis to look at those things. In verse 27 of 1 Corinthians 11, wherefore, whosoever shall eat of this bread and drink of this cup unworthily shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. Let a man examine himself, and so let him eat that bread and drink of that cup. For he that eats and drinks unworthily, and eats and drinks, or he will eat and drink damnation to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. That's someone who is just relaxed. He's not really realizing in his life on a daily basis the value of Christ's sacrifice and the forgiveness that we receive. For this cause many are weak and sickly. But verse 31, here is a principle, a life lesson. For if we would judge ourselves, if we would look at ourselves, examine ourselves, we should not be judged. Now notice what it explains here. But when you are judged, we are chastened of the Lord. Why? That we should not be condemned with the world. Romans 12 talks about being corrected because God loves us. So if we're looking at ourselves and we're examining ourselves and we're going to God and asking him to help us to see things we need to overcome, and we continue to stay close to him and we are growing in grace and knowledge, then God's not going to have to hit us over the head with a 2x4 to get our attention, because he's not going to allow you to keep going in the wrong direction without giving you a warning. He may tap you a little bit at first, and you keep going, and pretty soon he gets a bigger and bigger club out, gets your attention. You don't want to, why go through all that? Why not seek guidance and correction from God and ask God to help us to see ourselves so that, and help us to really, truly examine ourselves spiritually? He said, if you do it yourself, then you don't have to go through that. But if you won't, then God's going to have to take stronger measures. And he's going to have to chasten us so that we won't be condemned with the world. God loves us. God has gone out of his way to call us, and God is not going to give up until the job's done. And the only time God would not be able to do anything further is if you or I totally rejected God and said, I know God, but I don't care. I'm not doing it. With full knowledge. I have only met one person in all my years in the church that has ever said that. Most people, certainly, you know, they may drift away or do various things, but God corrects them and they come back and they respond and they repent, and God forgives them. We're here, coming up on the Passover time when we need to examine ourselves, but we need to also realize where we are in this prophetic thing. Could persecution begin to happen to us very quickly? Absolutely. Absolutely. With the political climate and sensitivities that people have today, anything could set it off. And then people would become ruthless. They just don't care. But whatever it's going to be pretty strong. And it may have to do with, you know, our effect on other countries. Who knows what it all is. But whatever it is, it's going to be pretty strong to make people kill you for it. And to betray, you know, family betraying one another and so on. What it is, we'll find out when it happens. But right now, we need to be examining ourselves and making sure that we are prepared and ready spiritually for whatever comes.